I'm inside the costume of Pubby, the WNPR Public Media Owl, our station mascot. Hey, kids, it's a great afternoon. Want to listen to Here and Now? They're talking about the Afghan presidential elections next spring. Or maybe a play about Lyndon Johnson. Hey, kids, don't run away. You know, I always wonder what it sounds like outside the costume.
Mom, why is that owl choking?
I don't know. Come on. We're late for your Chinese vibraphone class.
My what?
Never mind. Keep walking.
Today on the show, true stories from inside the mascot costume. And now, the guy inside Pinchy, the rhythmically squatting crab, Colin McEnroe.
Well, back in 2010, we did a show about mascots. When I say mascots, you go to a sporting event, there's somebody in a big costume, the symbol of the team. When I was in college, you know, there was a big blue bulldog, and I think the person inside it was whoever was willing to do it, whoever was big enough to fill the costume, and that was about it. But it's really changed a lot, and in fact, mascots go through a lot of training to do what they do. They develop their own fan followings. So in 2010, we did that show with some of the people who actually train mascots or are experts in mascotology. That included Roy Yarborough and David Raymond. You're going to hear a little bit of our conversation with them later, but we're doing a new interview today. It's with Kelly Frank. She's the owner and president of Amazing Mascots and a retired mascot for a variety of minor and major league teams during Major League Baseball's, Major League Baseball's Tampa Bay Rays. One of the reasons we're doing this is we're about to head into the baseball playoffs. And one of the peculiarities of baseball, and particularly of the Red Sox, the Boston Red Sox, who are going to be in the playoffs and who are obviously an area team for us, is that they are so popular with so-called Red Sox Nation that in some cases they invade ballparks that have rather low attendance, and they become a larger group in the ballpark than the actual fans of the home team. Kelly Frank was the Tampa Bay Rays mascot, Raymond, from I think about 2004 to about 2008. Why don't we just start there? Kelly Frank, one of the things that you have to learn to do, obviously, as the mascot is to excite and please the fans of your home team. But then there's this whole other set of skills that involves dealing with the fans of the other team that somehow or other have showed up in large numbers. Is that a special skill?
It was definitely a unique environment. I think Tampa Bay continues to kind of be a unique environment. And, you know, my family's from Massachusetts, but as a native Floridian who's grown up with Florida sports, it's kind of just like a kick to the teeth to just have your home arena taken over by an opposing fan base. And then as a performer, there's also a challenge because you still have to entertain and not concede to that, you know, majority and still be entertaining and not get in trouble. So it was definitely a delicate dance to do.
And sometimes literally a delicate dance to do. And you have a reputation, too, had a reputation of being one of the sort of spunkier mascots. I mean, a lot of us in that situation would maybe sort of cower and hope that the Red Sox fans didn't hurt us or dump beer on us or whatever a drunken Red Sox might do in a situation like that. You really engaged with these people some of the time. Tell us about that.
It used to start, because, like, back in 04, you know, 04 through 07, the Rays were pretty much the worst team in baseball, so it was just kind of hard to find ways to entertain, to find the best thing to do. And a lot of time, like I said, people would just kind of shy away. And I remember being on the third base side, because that was like the Red Sox dugout, and being on the dugout, and people were like, you know, you're on the wrong side, Raymond. And like, you know, screw you guys, this is my house. Now I'm going to continue to park myself on this dugout and do as much as I can at a distance so you can't grab me to still be entertaining and to try to create a home team advantage and a positive environment for our team. So basically it was a lot of you kind of poke the bear from afar, staying on the dugout where they can't get to you, staying there is an area behind the bullpen, the visitor's bullpen area where they can't get to you, and security was there. And on top of that, our security was always heightened when Boston was there, and they also knew to look out for me.
Mm-hmm.
So there, I kind of had that going to my advantage, too.
And so then what would you do? I mean, mascots, you can't talk, you can't yell, you can't vocalize, right? So what do you do?
Back in 07, and there's actually a video of it online, I came out there, because, you know, predominant, you know, Red Sox crowd, and it was 07, you know, before they won, but it was a big wild card chase, and, you know, obviously the Rays are out of it. I mean, it was a chase for the division, and, you know, the Sox fans were there being, you know, very, very confident. And so I just came out with a sign that says, you know, knock, knock. And the crowd's like, you know, repeats. And another sign, who's there? And they're like, and then the next sign is New York. You know, New York's knocking on your door.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just hear the whole crowd just like, after the punchline, they're just like, boo. And so it was stuff like that. So, I mean, you kind of had to just make fun of the situation because at that point, like, the Rays weren't really competing. So you have to reference other things that are going on in baseball.
Well, even taking the Red Sox out of the equation for a second, one issue for mascots is that people think that the mascots are sort of invincible or at least incapable of experiencing pain, right? People think that they can hit a mascot.
Well, it's really, I've been trying to figure out that phenomenon and see, I don't understand why anyone considers that appropriate, because I know, like, we're creating an illusion, but I don't know that we're that great of creating the illusion that we're a character or a cartoon character that, you know, you can Wile E. Coyote drop an anvil on us and we just bounce back. So I don't understand what would make, like, a grown adult come up and punch somebody they don't know just because they're wearing a fuzzy costume. You don't do that to clowns. Everybody would be like, yeah, why did you just go punch that clown? But for some reason, that mask, it gives us a lot of, you know, anonymousness as a performer, but also I think gives the person that kind of, that cover, like, you can't see their face, so I'm not hitting a real person.
So that happened to you? You got punched and jabbed and stuff like that?
It's happened so many times that, like, honestly, you can't even get mad anymore. I've been hit in the head so many times that you really have to connect in a right manner, like, somehow for it to go through the costume that it actually impacts my face for me to get mad. Because if I were to get mad at every person that hit me, slapped my head too hard and everything, I would just be mad, you know, like 90% of the time. So you learn to brush it off. And it's, like I said, that's one of the more amazing parts of the job, that you have to occasionally just literally roll with the punches.
Yeah. Okay, now you were asking before what would make a grown person think that they could punch a mascot. What would make a grown person want to be a mascot? This is a pretty peculiar thing that you've chosen. What drew you to this profession?
I was just always a big sports fan. I actually started off as a fan of the Florida Panthers hockey team because I went to my first game, and that was the year they went to the Stanley Cup, and I was just really hooked and wanted to be involved in sports. And, you know, I was a super fan back then of the Panthers and wanted to be involved any way I could. And I saw the mascot as a way to be down there on the ice, you know, to be the biggest fan. And then also I did, you know, theater throughout high school, and then it just became kind of like a merging of two of my favorite things, which were sports and theater, and it kind of just went from there and became like its own thing. Because there are different types of mascots. There are people that are just walking around in costume, and then there are performers and entertainers who treat it like a theater, basically.
Well, and that was said a lot about you. And when you were let go by the Rays, one of the fans said, it's like losing a player. She was always amped up, funny without saying anything. She really explored every aspect and every way to get people involved. I mean, people knew who you were to a certain degree. Although, did people know the name Kelly Raymond when you were inside these various costumes, whether it was the Lightning or the Rays? Did fans, super fans, know that it was you?
I try to keep a somewhat low profile. I did do a couple of interviews, but I try to not be as big of a profile because I just honestly didn't want people to know there was a woman in costume,
mm-hmm.
as it just makes it that much more difficult for me to portray that character. And, you know, you sit there because I'm playing a male character, and then all of a sudden someone would be like, oh, that's a girl in there. But then also, it would have also been beneficial sometimes because I think people would be less likely to punch me.
Mm-hmm.
But I did manage to keep it somewhat under the radar. But people kind of know you by your actions and how you react and how you dance and how you move. So I think people kind of recognize me more as my performance than so much as my name.
You studied with David Raymond, who we're going to hear a little bit later. What did you study? What is there that a prospective mascot would study?
For the thing that Dave was the master of and what he really, you know, taught me was really just subtlety, because being a mascot is not just big emotions. And, you know, as they would say, like in acting, if you have like a 1 through 10, it's not like being at a 10 the entire time. Like, you're not at a level 10 energy the entire game because you can't do it. It's kind of having that ebbs and flows, like going all the way down to a 1, then a 5, then going up to a 10, and having that kind of range of emotions and character, which I'm not sure that a lot of people consider. And I think that's what makes a difference between like a good and bad mascot. And that's something that Dave really taught me was doing those levels of emotion. One of my favorite things that he ever did as the Fanatic was just subtlety, a turn of the head, just an expression. Like, you could just look and see, like, you could read what he was saying. Like, you heard what he was saying, even though he wasn't saying anything. You're like, oh man, he just said, oh, are you freaking kidding me? Like, look at this guy. And so that's what I learned from him and was able to like take and kind of make into my own little character.
You're owner and president of Amazing Mascots now. Does that mean you're tutoring, mentoring other people on how to be mascots?
Yes, I do some. I went and worked with the Winston-Salem Dash, which is an affiliate of the Chicago White Sox. Earlier in the year, I went down there and worked with their performers and their management, and then actually hopped in costume too and worked a couple of games. I used to train the University of Florida mascots. I've done some training for the American University. And I'm actually trying to set up a mascot boot camp up here in Chicago through one of the theater companies.
Is it different, say, at the minor league level? I mean, I just feel like maybe all my ideas about this are conditioned by the movie Bull Durham. But we're going to be talking to Rocky a little bit later on, the mascot of the New Britain Rockcats. But is in a minor league ballpark, is the mascot, I don't know, a little bit closer to the fans, a little bit more accessible? Does it work that way?
Yeah, the mascots in the minor leagues are even more important than in the majors in most respects, because with the minor leagues, you really don't – players are gone so fast, and it's such a revolving door of players. You know, your top player is hopefully going to move on up and get out of there. So the only consistent face of the franchise is the mascot.
It does seem as though, as a mascot, you engage the fan. I mean, I'm a Red Sox fan, and I don't know who Wally is, and I don't really think too much about Wally at all, ever. I mean, he might be great. I don't know. I just don't know. But when you were fired, I mean, the fans started online petitions to get you back and things like that. They didn't want to lose you. What's that all about? How did you forge that kind of bond with a fan base?
I think one of the things, you know, first off, it's also like a different environment in a place like Tampa, where, you know, the entertainment and your sideshow is a little bit more in the limelight, because the players, you know, we're not the Red Sox at that point. So I think it was the mascot's a little bit more important in markets like that. And the thing that I always felt I was kind of the best at was engaging the crowd and knowing the feeling of the game and knowing when to, you know, get them going and knowing when to get out of the way. Because one of the fortunate things about me is I'm a baseball fan and I'm knowledgeable about the game of baseball. So I know what's going on and I know how to react. I've seen other people that are just bopping along, doing their shtick, taking pictures, blocking people's views when the bases are loaded. There's, you know, you're down by one run and your star hitter is in the batting box, and I just want to go down there and just yell at them, be like, sit down, just get out of the way. Like, so I guess it would be more like just my crowd interaction and then just timing, which I think is very hard to teach somebody and also very hard to duplicate.
It also may be the case, too. I mean, Tampa Bay is a young franchise and probably pretty much always had a mascot. The Red Sox did not have a mascot for most of their history. And my recollection, once again, as a Red Sox fan, is that when Wally was introduced, which was not all that many years ago, he walked out on the field and the fans booed him on his first day. They didn't like the way he looked. They didn't think they were going to like him at all. I mean, I think he's since then become more beloved by the fans. But their initial reaction was, we don't even like you, and you're our own mascot. What are the differences among fans? Like, Philadelphia has this reputation. It's even there in Silver Lining Playbook, the movie, you know, of these kind of maniac fans. At one point, the Philadelphia Eagles had, I think, in their stadium, a kind of mini court with an actual judge, like a real judge, where fans could be arraigned without leaving the premises. Is that a deserved reputation? Are Philly fans tough?
I would say that 100%. Honestly, like I said, with my family being from Massachusetts, I like the Red Sox and their fans and enjoyed annoying them. But after the 08, after the ALCS, it was such a horrible experience. Like, the fans are just so, you know, in my face, throwing beers at me, just all this stuff that I was so so upset, and I was just like, oh my gosh, like, I don't know if I could ever, you know, enjoy the Red Sox again. And then we went to Philadelphia, and then I was like, oh, okay, there's somebody who's way worse than you guys. Going to the, and I didn't go there in costume. I went there out of costume just as a fan, and just dealing with the people, it was so miserable. Like, I knew people that didn't even go on the trip because they knew how the fans were. We were there for two games, and people actually just didn't even go to the second game because it was such a miserable experience. And, I mean, it was so bad that, because I had hung around, I was trying to see game five, I hung around in the town, and I only brought, like, my Rays jacket, and it was pretty cold up there, and I was so tired of being harassed by everybody from the public transportation to checking into the hotel that I just stopped wearing my jacket and walked around freezing, because I would rather freeze than continue to fight with the Philly fans.
Are there, you know, as a mascot, you're mainly performing in your home stadium. You're not going to really encounter, you're not going to be in a different ballpark, except I would imagine under very special circumstances. But did you get a sense, maybe just even within the AL East, the Yankees, the Blue Jays, the Orioles, I mean, you must interact somewhat anyway with their fans, the ones who would show up at Tampa. Did you get a sense about how they interact with mascots and whether there are kind of differences from fan base to fan base?
Everywhere in the AL East except for Baltimore, but I've been on the field with Baltimore and with their mascot. I did get to go up in 07, went up to Fenway and did a brief little skit with Wally, and it was pretty awesome. It was pretty fun. It was a positive response to the skit because Wally went up to me, but then I ran out of there, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm getting out of this crowd so fast. And then in 2008, we did the All-Star game in New York and, you know, had fun with that, and I've also performed multiple times in Toronto. I know you guys don't like the Yankees fans, but to be honest with you, I've never had a problem with them.
Mm-hmm.
They've always been pretty courteous. Toronto fans are just some of the nicest fans. I don't know if it's because they're Canadian.
Because they're Canadian. That's why
they're
Canadian.
They're so nice. They're just like, and I work spring training for the Blue Jays as their mascot, and I remember working the crowd. I'm like, this is like the nicest crowd ever. Like, they would actually come up to you and be like, you're doing a real good job, Ace. Like, you're so nice. And I'm like, oh man, I love this crowd. Baltimore was very similar to Tampa Bay's fan base because it's just, you know, a fan base of a long struggling franchise. And so they're very similar in that. And then I'm trying to think. And I actually did perform once in Philly in 2006, but I was only on the field.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I did the same skit where I did with Wally, where I let the fanatic one up. You know, I had a tearaway outfit, and he tore off my fur, and the character was, like, you know, naked underneath.
Yeah.
And it was kind of funny because I remember doing that skit and being on the field, and it was just a very simple introduction. They're like, you know, ladies and gentlemen from the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, Raymond. And just 38,000 people just booing the crap out of me. And then when the fanatic came and ripped off my clothes, he was like, oh, that was one of the best reactions I've ever gotten. So it's fun. Like, I'm sure Philly fans are fine in their own environment, but for a visiting person and then in other people's stadiums, they're not exactly fun.
One of the great mysteries of sports, of baseball, if you're a fan, is, you know, a guy gets a walk or a single and he's down there and he's always talking to the first baseman. They're talking. They're usually smiling, too, you know, back and forth. And you can never get baseball players to tell you what it is that they're talking about. But so now that you tell me these stories, I wonder if two mascots get together and let's say, you know, you don't know each other super well, but you're there on the same field performing together. If you run into a mascot you don't know that well, what are you guys going to wind up talking about?
Small industry that most of us do know each other, and then sometimes, especially on the minor league or collegiate level, it's kind of dangerous to go out there with a mascot that you don't know and interact, because half the time their inclination is to start fighting you. Usually we do end up knowing each other and talking beforehand, because if not, that can kind of lead to some issues. But as far as, like, you're talking about, like, conversations that people have, the funny thing is that sometimes you're in costume and, you know, you go up and do your stretching routine with the players, and the players are talking to you, and you're just sitting there having a conversation with the players that, you know, none of the fans can see what's going on or hear what the mascot says, but I always thought that was kind of...
What do the players talk to you about?
So they'll just ask, like who, you know, who's in there, who's doing this and that, and then I remember one of the funnier exchanges is that one of the players asked me, he's like, oh, so what are you wearing under there? I'm like... I'm like, a T-shirt. He's like, that's all? I was like, and shorts. He's like, that's it? I was like, well, sometimes I wear pantyhose, but that's just for me. So it's they're baseball players, so there's a gambit of questions that they ask.
Right. Yeah, I mean, professional athletes have a notoriously limited set of interests, and I think we just covered one of the big ones just there.
Yeah, basically. What are you wearing?
We're talking to Kelly Frank right now. One of the other things you've gotten involved in is a whole issue of costumes, costumes themselves, making them, designing them, what they should look like. I'm assuming for a lot of your career as a mascot, you were climbing into a suit that somebody else made, and that somebody else probably was not him or herself a mascot, not somebody who actually had to have the experience of dancing around in the thing that they made or designed. I assume that that's true, and if so, what, as a mascot, can you contribute to the design of costumes that makes them better?
My main thing is vision. I need to be able to see, and then, you know, ventilation. I need to be able to breathe, and movement, small feet that, you know, that I can walk and not trip over. A fur body that's as light as it could possibly be, considering the design, and then also being machine washable, because as a mascot, you know, you're sweating so much, you need to be able to clean your suit, and you need to be able to, and as a, you know, especially in baseball, you need something that's going to be able to be cleaned easily, because you're not going to have time to go run to a laundromat or spend a day cleaning it. Like, you really need something you can just throw in the washing machine, put on a fan, and have it dry in a couple hours. And so that's how I design all my costumes.
And we see all your costumes. I mean, the Miami Heat mascot Bernie, for example, he's part of your. I mean, I don't know how involved you were in designing Bernie.
Oh no, we just did. We just made him for the playoffs. They needed an all white version of the character, and they had a very short time span that they needed that, because during their playoffs they'll do like a whiteout, and so they needed him and they wanted him. Like, normally it takes about 8 to 10 weeks to do a costume, and then my crew was able to do that in 2 weeks.
Mm. But it must be kind of exciting to turn on the TV and see a mascot that's not you that you had something to do with.
It was pretty neat, because I actually got to go down there when they won last year. I went to a game when they played the Celtics, and as I'm walking up to American Airlines Arena, they have a big video board on the outside, and they saw whiteout Bernie. So, like, I'm walking into arena and I see one of the costumes I helped produce out there, and you're like, this is amazing. Like, I don't work for the Miami Heat. I'm not their mascot. I'm not going to get to step on that court. But in my own small way, I got to be a part of that.
You know, you're an incredibly popular mascot, and obviously also a very engaging person to talk to. And that's why it's sort of surprising for me to read that you have actually gotten fired occasionally from mascot jobs. What do you tell mascots now about what they can and can't do so that they keep their jobs?
Basically, don't do anything that I do. It's very hard now. It's kind of, because I was thinking about this the other day, because, you know, there's a lawsuit that's hitting the Missouri Supreme Court right now because of the Royals mascot threw a hot dog, and a guy is, you know, suing them about that. And that's all the way in the Missouri Supreme Court. So I was just reading that. I'm like, you know, this isn't even fun anymore, when, you know, you have to worry about not only all your legitimate concerns about being a performer, but now you have to worry about, if you're tossing a hot dog, am I going to end up in the Supreme Court for a case? So I think this litigious society has kind of put the handcuffs on a lot of mascots, and there's a majority of teams that it's just they're so worried about being sued that they've handcuffed their mascots so more that I don't think mascots are really allowed to perform. There's a handful of teams that know the value of their mascot and back up their performers. Like the Chicago Bulls come to mind. Like, they have an extraordinary performer who's had someone try to sue him for a high five, you know, and they stand behind him. And because they stand behind him, he's got all this freedom to be just an amazing performer. And that's just becoming more and more rare. I'm seeing more and more just Mickey Mouse, Happy Handshaker mascots, because it seems these days a lot of teams would rather just have a photo opportunity than to have an actual entertainer.
Yeah. Well, Kelly Frank, you are an entertainer. What a great interview, too. Thanks so much for joining us. Great to talk to Kelly Frank, owner and president of Amazing Mascots, a retired mascot for a variety of minor and major league teams. When we come back, we'll continue with Mascot Talk after this. Hey! No, actually, that's the favorite song of the Philly Fanatic, along with Roy Yarbrough, the guru of mascotology from Sports Management Studies at California University of Pennsylvania. We are now joined also by David Raymond, the original Philly Fanatic and currently the Emperor of Fun and Games at Raymond Entertainment Group. Welcome, Dave Raymond.
Hey, Colin, how are you doing?
Just great. So tell us a little bit of the story of the Philly Fanatic. How did you become such a thing?
Well, certainly you don't go to school to be a professional idiot. There's no higher degree for that. I actually was going to the University of Delaware. I wanted to coach and teach, and my father's Tubby Raymond. He's in the College Football Hall of Fame, and he kept trying to tell me that being a coach wasn't as easy as his life made it seem. And I got a part-time job with the Phillies in 1976, and in 76, 77, I worked for him as an intern, and I was low man on the totem pole. And in 1978, they actually called me in my fraternity house on campus and said, hey, we want you to stay for the games. You know, you can keep your same job during the day, but if you promise to stay for the games, you know, you'll have a job. We'll pay you even more hours, and we'll pay you $25 a game. And I'm like, I'm in.
Yeah. You
know, I wanted a job with the Phillies at that point. And I barely even listened to them when they described what it was they wanted me to do. And, of course, it was to be the person inside the Fanatic. And at that time, no one even knew what the Fanatic was going to look like. So I basically raised my hand because I wanted to prove to the Phillies I'd do anything for them to get a full-time job. And, you know, 16 years later, in 93, that's when I left the Phillies. And up until the last couple of years, that was the best success the Phillies had on the field as well. So the Fanatic got some credit for them playing well, too. So it was just a perfect storm of being at the right place at the right time. And obviously, I was one of those crazy Phillies fans that had carte blanche to go anywhere I wanted to. And no one stopped a giant green furry Muppet from going anywhere. And it was just really magic.
Well, you know, this is also kind of a moment in Major League Baseball, because this whole idea of somebody in a costume wasn't something that had been around for a really long time. But the San Diego Chicken, I think, maybe started it sometime in the 70s. By the time you became the Philly Fanatic, I don't think it was still a pretty new phenomenon, the idea of anybody in a costume doing hijinks, right?
You know, I think the big difference was, you know, when the Chicken came on board about 3 or 4 years before the Fanatic was created, and one of the reasons why the Phillies created the Fanatic was because the Chicken was having success in San Diego. And, you know, in San Diego, it was a military base with a beach back then. And the Padres weren't winning any games, and the Chicken came in and became a distraction. I mean, people were watching the Chicken more than they were watching baseball. And when the Phillies saw that, they said, hey, you know, we're on the cutting edge of promotions and fun. We've got to do this. And so they created the Fanatic. And it was the Fanatic and the Chicken were the two characters that really did more than walk around and wave. They actually became part of the reason why you'd come to the stadium. You'd bring your kids, you know, you'd bring the grandparents, you'd bring mom to a Phillies game, because there was more than just baseball going on. And the Fanatic was a big part of that.
You know, Philadelphia fans have kind of a reputation. And I mean, this is like, you know, the Phillies, I think they tased somebody on the field. And for a while, the Eagles actually had like a little courtroom, I think, down in the bottom of their stadium where they could actually arraign people. And so, you know, you're out there in a costume hopping around. I mean, was it always a wonderful, benign, happy interaction with the fans, or did they want to like throw you off the upper deck?
Well, you know, Colin, it's funny that you say that, and certainly that's the reputation that the Philadelphia fans have. And I was one of those fans. I mean, I never got arrested, and I never got tasered, which, you know, my mom was thrilled about that. But, you know, I was there. I saw it. I grew up there. So if you're there and you understand it, you can be safe in that environment by just not being stupid. You know, you don't wear a Cowboys jersey to an Eagles game. You know, you don't wear a Mets jersey or a Yankees jersey to a Phillies game. I mean, it's simple common sense. The people that got in trouble decided to puff their chest out and say, I'm a Yankees fan, I'm a Mets fan, I'm going to, you know, represent. Those people were in trouble. But the Fanatic was, you know, the embodiment, the living, breathing extension of those Phillies fans. So I was never in trouble. As a matter of fact, if somebody said something bad to the Fanatic, those people were in trouble.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'll never forget, Met fans jumped on me in 1984, back when the Mets were winning and the Phillies were probably in last place or close to the bottom of the Eastern Division, and a bunch of Met fans jumped on me. There were so many police officers and Phillies fans that came to my rescue, you would have thought that the Pope was getting attacked. And and so in reality, I was the quintessential Teflon personality. The Fanatic couldn't do anything wrong, and the fans loved him. And honestly, over 16 years of doing it, I can count on one hand that a Phillies fan said something negative.
I want to ask Roy Yarbrough, you know, in terms of the length and breadth of the history of mascots, in a way it does seem like the San Diego Chicken and the Philly Fanatic introduced kind of a new thing. As Dave Raymond is saying, it became kind of a thing where instead of watching the game sometimes, particularly if the game was depressing in one way or another, you watch the mascot. Was that kind of a sea change for mascots?
It was. It all gets back to marketing and promotion. I can feel David's pain being in the Pittsburgh area, and we have a parrot that they work him harder than some of the players, and I guess if the parrot got too good, they'd trade him off.
Another thing that's happened is the teams have added yet another kind of sideshow, which is often these weird races. I think out in Wisconsin, they have brats that are people dressed up in bratwurst costumes that do races along the field during dead moments in the game. And now Pittsburgh had added these racing pierogies. And it turned out one of them had some unkind things to say about the management of the Pittsburgh franchise and was.
And got fired.
Yeah, got fired. And then rehired.
He got rehired
because the Pittsburgh Pirates said they hadn't followed their HR policies. This is a $25 a night job. But anyway.
Colin, they have interns, which I have several interns up there from our university, and kind of, hey, kid, you doing anything tonight? The guy didn't show up. You're in the costume.
Yeah.
Make it work, you know. And Dave can talk a little bit about more training that needs to go into that.
What's interesting, you know, Roy and Colin, the difference between the Phillies and the Pirates in terms of an organization, both great organizations, both have had a series of successes on field, and their organizations are certainly Phillies organization has been respected over time, and the Pirates have done some great things. But the difference between the two organizations, I believe, is that I find that the Phillies organization over time has embraced fun as being a very important part of what they do from a marketing standpoint. So it's not just the Fanatic, but it's virtually everything they do. They say, look, where is the fun in this? How are we going to make this fun? And the Pirates, I don't think they've embraced that like the Phillies have. And although I think they've done a good job with marketing, I don't think anybody beats the Phillies in understanding that people are showing up there not just because the Phillies are playing baseball. They've got a lot of other things on their minds. And in terms of the business of sports, to sell 45,000 to 65,000 tickets, you better be doing more than just trying to win baseball games. And the Phillies have always understood that, and I think that's why they've always raised the bar in terms of how many people came into that stadium throughout the year.
We're talking about mascots today, and we also welcome your stories and memories and comments about mascots. You may tweet us at WNPRColin, and you can email us at Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at WNPR.org. Dave Raymond, a former Philly Fanatic, now you actually do kind of a mini camp, right? A boot camp for people who want to be mascots?
Yeah, we find that it's over the years I had people asking me, 17, 18 years ago, people were saying, hey, you should have a camp. And I said, well, I'm building a business. I can't lose focus. And then I found that a lot of kids were going to quasi-performer camps, and they weren't getting their money's worth. So I created one about 18 years ago, and it's been really fun to watch people who are passionate about doing it right. So we try to teach them how to be safe for themselves and safe for the audience, but also what they need to practice on to be good performers. And it's really a beginning acting course is what we teach. But we also teach about physical fitness and nutrition and also how to make sure that they are doing things properly to be funny, but at the same time, safe. Boot camp has been very, very successful for us. And I've seen hundreds and even thousands of kids come by who are getting scholarships to go to school to be mascot performers. And I just think it's awesome that type of performance is being valued and respected.
You know, one of the things that I've noticed in terms of, since we're bringing up this whole area of being safe, is NBA mascots seem to do more feats of daring do. I mean, there's the Phoenix Gorilla, who's always been doing lots of things like dunking off of trampolines and stuff like that. But I don't know, does either one of you want to comment on that?
Well, I'll let Roy speak to it, because Roy's been involved with some of the NBA performers too. But that really is the gorilla who... Bob Wolf, who was the second performer for the Gorilla and the one that really put a stamp on NBA performers being athletic. He was a gymnast, mm-hmm. and a high-level gymnast at a Division I school. I believe he went to Arizona. And he came in and personified that Gorilla and had him doing just crazy stunts. And the rest of the NBA said, oh, okay, that's the way our characters need to be. And really the birth of that physicality has been from Bob Wolf and his inhabitation of the gorilla, who is in the Mascot Hall of Fame, one of the original inductees. And so the rest of the NBA said, okay, our characters have to learn how to go off a mini tramp and dunk. And that's why the NBA has been proliferated by mascots that do physical stuff.
Roy Yarbrough, did you want to add to or elaborate on that?
Well, one of the things Dave can reiterate as well is the auditions that these folks go through. I know Dave's company helps run the auditions, and you just can't walk in there and say, hey, I really want to be a mascot. It takes a lot of preparation, even at the college ranks when these students are going after scholarships. They have to perform. I work with Capital One's competition as well, the Mascot Challenge, and I tell you, they're looking for folks who can turn the crowd on, who are very marketable. When they do these commercials for the Capital One Bowl, they are extremely interested in having mascots out there that's going to have a big following, will get a lot of votes, but also who can perform the task. And this is where Dave's company comes in to work with these organizations and also the universities to say, hey, folks, you better, you know, get a better costume, you better have your safety regs set up. And so it's just something that has evolved more so from a marketing aspect of how much money these mascots can make for the organizations.
There is a lot of money in mascots, and the Philly Fanatic himself was very, very lucrative for the Phillies, and I think probably continues to be. Let's talk to Sherry in Norwich, who has a question/comment. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, Colin. Hi, gentlemen.
Hi.
Hello.
I had a comment and a question. Mm-hmm. Number one, I'm in Norwich, so mm-hmm. we have a minor league baseball team here, which started out as the Navigators. We had Tater the Gator. Then we moved on to being the Connecticut Defenders. So then we had Cutter the Submarine, which I can't quite wrap my head around. And then now we've got the Tigers, and that's fairly self-explanatory. I'm wondering if that's just sort of a marketing ploy to extend the life of leftover merchandise. But my question is, back years ago, I was a window dresser for Sears.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to, sometimes with my department, we would get the short straw mm-hmm. and have to wear the big Winnie the Pooh costume. And it's a full body costume. And I would have to go after the guy Tubby Guy would decide that he wanted to dress down to his boxer shorts inside the costume because it was so hot.
Yeah.
And it was like getting inside a giant sponge. Not to mention that the vision was so limited. There was nothing, you couldn't see downward, mm-hmm. and you had no peripheral vision. And people would hand you their babies to have their picture taken. And if these parents had to wear that Winnie the Pooh head for about 2 seconds, they would never hand their babies to you again. But they never had to wear the hat.
Yeah.
So my question is, how are the actual costumes? Have they come a long way in ventilation? Are they safer? What's the visual like?
All right. Well,
where's the physicality?
We certainly have the right people to ask about that. I also want to mention, Tucker Ives, who's helped produce this show today, was telling me about Norwich, and he says the other mascots are still there, like Tater the Gator, and the other one are like still around.
They kept all three.
Yeah, that's really weird.
Yep.
They're just hanging out there, these kind of meaningless mascots. All right. Well, Dave Raymond, we'll start with you because. What is it like inside the costumes, and can people see okay?
I'm absolutely thrilled that Sherry's called in because she just brought everybody right into my world. one of the negatives of being a mascot performer is I got sick and tired of taking showers. I was taking 3 and 4 showers a day. But here's the deal. Yes, the answer to your question is the companies that really invest in this correctly have mascot costumes that are engineered. You'll never stop it from being hot. You'll never stop performers from sweating and have to deal with extreme conditions. And you have to be in shape. You have to be physically fit to do this. But let's just talk about the Fanatic costume that was built in 1978. The woman that designed the Fanatic was actually one of Jim Henson's original designers. She was on a group of people that designed Miss Piggy and Statler and Waldorf, the two old guys that sit up in the in the theater balcony. Those are designs that Bonnie engineered and was part of designing. She understood how performers need to be able to be unrestricted to be good. So the Fanatic had marvelous vision. And he looked like he was 350 pounds, but there was very little restrictions for me as a performer. And I was virtually able to do walk, dance, jump, do anything physical that I wanted to do, and that costume did not inhibit me. The only thing was is it was hot. So a costume that's designed really well, and many, many, many of them are, but the one, Sherry, that you had experience with was a stock costume that was built to Disney specifications, and it is what it is. It's a big-headed, pajama-wearing style character costume. But the costumes that we create at Raymond Entertainment, my company, and the costumes that Bonnie Erickson and Acme Mascots create, they're high-engineered, well-designed costumes that know the performer has to be able to move well to be great.
We should mention that Bonnie Erickson also designed the costume for Dandy, the tragic New York Yankees mascot who was about to sort of make a big debut. We mentioned this before, right around the time that Lou Piniella had a run-in with the San Diego Chicken, causing George Steinbrenner to denounce mascots in general and say they had no place on the field days or weeks before this character was about to debut. Yeah.
And I remember Bonnie and her husband, Wade, who owned the company at the time, Harrison Erickson, that they were incredulous. They're like, what is he saying? How can he be saying this? He just got done contracting with us, and we're just about ready to roll up this character, and he's denouncing the character, and certainly that was the nail in the coffin that killed Dandy.
Dandy was exiled to the very dangerous upper deck of Yankee Stadium. All right, we're going to take a little break here. When we come back, we'll also be talking to Rocky, the mascot of the New Britain Rock Cats.
Sorry, lady.
Ow!
Look, I'm an owl. Owls climb up on things.
I'm gonna sue you.
Yeah, right. I bet you're gonna say I'm the one that made that puncture wound. Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me, with help from our interns, Corey Breen and Greg Dyson. The part of Bill Curry was played by Nightmare Ant. On Monday's show, the future of urban parks. And now, back to Colin.
Joining us right now, we have Roy Yarbrough. He's the author of Mascots, the History of Senior and Community College and University Mascots, the guru of mascotology. He's the director of sports management studies at California University of Pennsylvania. And Dave Raymond, he's the original Philly Fanatic and currently the emperor of fun and games at Raymond Entertainment Group. Also with us is Rocky. Rocky is the mascot for the New Britain Rockcats, a very successful and beloved minor league baseball team in New Britain, Connecticut. Hello, Rocky.
Well, hello. Actually, I'm not Rocky. I'm Rocky's mascot. I'm the spokesperson for Rocky.
So Rocky himself does not speak?
He does not speak. No, he just, I'm the voice of Rocky. And so when we're out and about and if kids have questions or Rocky can't communicate, his mascot's the one that speaks on his behalf.
I want to ask Dave Raymond a question about that. Do mascots, are there any mascots that talk, or is it just kind of a rule that they have to be silent?
Well, it certainly is one of those unwritten rules that performers really feel like it's something that they can't break that barrier. But our character, Reggie, he's the Purple Party dude. He's had a voice. We have a YouTube site, Reggie TV, where he introduces where he's going to be. He's done a lot of local entertainment. We have a children's show and a children's theater, and it's been wildly successful. And my character that I helped create the sport with Harrison Erickson, when I left the Phillies, sport had a voice, and we've really found a great deal of success in it. So most people don't do it because they've got to get a performer who then can replicate that voice. So that there's a danger in creating a voice because multiple performers exist in minor league sports. So I love it when a character speaks.
Yeah, but this, I think this is the reason why Rocky has a spokesperson, because how could you recreate his voice? So Rocky, Evan, I have to ask about Rocky. How does Rocky deal with the heat? It gets hot here in Connecticut during the summer. I mean, we're not Carolina, we're not Georgia, but it gets hot here. What is it like for the Rocky character?
Well, you got to stay plenty hydrated. Drinking lots of water will help you out. You know, some suits do have a fan in it. Dave could probably tell you about that. But we find that having a fan in there, it just blows around hot air. You know, it really just makes it a sauna in there. So that doesn't work as well. It's staying cool, taking breaks, staying, you know, being careful, not overexerting yourself with it, the suit, being in the suit. So it's really trying to stay cool. Some people do wear ice packs under their suits to keep them cool, but you know, once you get to a certain level of being hot, there's no difference, and you're just in a different zone.
would you agree with that, Dave Raymond?
Well, it's funny. It was perfect. That sounds like it's right out of our manual. Hydrate, take breaks, and you know, I used to just strap ice in a Ziploc bag, crushed ice in a Ziploc bag. I use a pitcher strap to strap it right to my stomach. Mm-hmm. I've never found anything more efficient than that. But the bottom line is, even with ice on you, you're going to be hot. You're going to sweat. Even when it's 32, 34 degrees outside, if you're in a parade, you're going to be sweating. So the bottom line is, it's going to be hot when you're a mascot. You can't change that. You just got to make sure you take breaks and drink a lot of water.
And if you hydrate a lot, I mean, then you're going to have to go to the bathroom. I mean, I don't know. Is there like a trap door or something in these costumes? You have to get all the way out of the costume to go to the bathroom?
You have to know where your zipper is.
Well, that's good advice for anybody, really, when you think about it.
Of course.
We got a couple of calls here, including Sandy from Vernon, who actually is descended, I guess, from royalty in a way. Hi, Sandy.
Hi there. Yes, I am descended from royalty. Max Peck, and the Clown Prince of Baseball, was my uncle.
Hmm. Oh, my. Max is I just love Max. I was very good friends with Max and miss him dearly.
Well, and I think he was not maybe the first, but he was the beginning of the entertain the fans at the baseball stadium.
It was him and Al Schacht. I mean, matter of fact, Max was a disciple of Al Schacht, and those were guys that used to have they'd have a Jeep. Al Schacht had a Jeep. He'd hit a fungo bat, drive the Jeep, and catch the fly ball. I mean, Max was one of the all-time great. Max's struggle was, he didn't have a costume. Everything that he did was because of his talent. There was nobody better, funnier, or more important to this type of sports entertainment than Max Packin, and that's why he was called the king.
Yeah, that is. First of all, Sandy, thanks for sharing that with you. We didn't realize we had one of Max's relatives living right nearby and listening to the show. That's very exciting. We're going to end with a quick trivia question, I guess, from Parker in Hartford. Hi, Parker. Can you make it fast?
Hello, Colin.
Yeah, can you do it fast?
Two schools playing basketball. They both have the same. They had the same mascot. Do you know what the two schools were?
And this could probably happens all the time. Was there another wrinkle like
had to change their names because they were politically incorrect?
Roy's going to know this answer.
Roy, do you know this one?
Well, I would speculate it's probably dealing with the either Warriors or Indians, something along that line.
What comes
to mind?
What's the answer, Parker?
They're Redmen.
The Redmen of
UMass and St. John's.
All right.
I know the UMass one is now the Minutemen. What is a Red Storm?
All right. We're going to have to say goodbye to everybody right now. Thank you for that call. And thank you especially to Roy Yarborough and Dave Raymond. Terrific guests here. We've been exploring the world of mascotology. Enjoy your weekend. We'll be back with an exciting new show, an exciting week, as you heard Kyan say, of new shows. Thanks to everybody who helped out today, everybody who called in, and to Tucker Ives, who helped get us ready for this, and our producer, Patrick Scahill. See you on Tuesday.
I'm Kyan Wolf. Okay, everybody, give me a W. I mean, if you don't want to, you don't have to. It's okay. We have so many W's here at the station. Get me out of here.